Thanks for the organizers for putting together such an outstanding panel. I'm sorry I could not be here in person, and I appreciate Professor Roberts stepping in to give this talk in my absence. 100 years ago, cancer in general, and breast cancer particularly, was not viewed as an equal opportunity to disease, but rather a specific concern of white, well-to-do women, as the top image suggests. This paper, drawn from my recently published book, How Cancer Crossed the Color Line, describes and analyzes historical shifts in cancer epidemiology and awareness. It touches on how a wide range of factors, from migration to political activism to the rise of government programs, reshaped cancer awareness. Today, I'll give you only a small sample from the book, looking at public health depictions of cancer along lines of race and gender. When I began the book, much of what many observers knew about cancer and color came from stories like this one in the New York Times, 2002, describing prostate cancer as part of a new racial divide for men. The story drew attention to the fact that black men were more likely than their white counterparts to die early from heart disease, cancer, and diabetes. And stories like this drew my attention to the role of the media in shaping explanations of such disparities. In this particular article, a common theme of the time focused on the role of distrust among black men in prostate cancer mortality. As the article noted, in black men, quote, distrust of the system and difficulties in communication are pervasive, end quote. The implication was clear. Where there was no trust, men delayed in bringing their concerns to the attention of healthcare providers. Diagnoses were made at later stages, and mortality rates were higher. These stories routinely engaged in wide-ranging speculation about the reasons for such health disparities, some pointing to the trust gap, others speculating, as did one 1988 paper, that the occurrence of prostate, and this is a quote, the occurrence of prostate cancer in blacks may be related to a heightened sexual activity or venereal disease. Yet others wondered about other factors, genetics, behavior, diet, or the environment. This was the nature of the conversation in the media and scientific literature when I took up the long historical study of race and cancer. What I found in looking back on the history of theories of race and cancer was that this is not a new story. For at least 100 years from the birth of modern cancer awareness until today, theories of racial identity and difference have been deeply entangled in theories of the dread disease. What surprised me, however, was what became the book's primary puzzle. And this was that for the first half century in the United States, this was the face of cancer awareness, with widespread concern about the rising toll of the disease among white Anglo-American women whose statistics showed were the leading victims of the disease. It was only since the 1970s that epidemiologists began to document and the media began to express or cover a rising concern with the, quote, alarming increase in cancer mortality among black Americans, end quote. The picture on the right is of the singer Minnie Riperton, who became a prominent face of this new cancer threat in the 1970s. As one observer commented, cancer is not a white disease anymore, end quote. African-American cancer mortality, noted in Newsweek in 1971, had been, quote, rising steadily since the beginning of the century, but had now taken an alarming turn. It was from the vantage point of the 1970s that epidemiologists began to look back and to argue that somewhere in the 1950s, cancer had crossed the color line, becoming more of a mortal threat to, quote, non-whites than to whites. It was here that they also began to speculate about how this had occurred, whether it was a real shift in mortality or a shift in the perceptions, and what factors had driven this transformation. This is the primary puzzle taken up in my book, which, one, takes readers from the era when cancer was widely understood as a white plague, but two, one making slow and steady progress among so-called primitive peoples, and racial divide that, three, became the basis for many of the cancer interventions we still practice today, and four and five, how and why views on that divide changed in the context of the 1960s and 1970s. It concludes by examining the legacy of that history. Today I can only look briefly at, excuse me, Today I can only look briefly at one aspect of this transformation, the history of communicating about cancer and the role of media, popular and scientific media, that is, in the early years. Using that one case, I'll say a few words about the long-term public policy implications of how cancer awareness in America laid down its roots. The historical case allows us to see more clearly the racial character of cancer awareness. That is how ideas about race and gender vulnerability gave rise to modern ideas about self-surveillance, the internalization of risk, and the impetus for women to link self-surveillance to better health outcomes. The standard view of cancer mortality is conveyed by the words of Prudential Life Insurance chief statistician Frederick Hoffman, who noted in 1915 that, quote, without exception, the general cancer mortality is higher for the white population than the Negro, end quote. Tables like the one below documented the mortality trends clearly as statisticians saw them. In 1920, the death rate per 100,000 whites was 86.44, as compared with 47.77 among the colored population. By 1929, the figure had risen to 105.39 for whites and 61.5 for colored. Of course, there are many problems with such numbers. We can criticize their limitations from several angles. As many observers noted, much of what was known about cancer came from either insurance data or data gathered from states where cancer deaths were registered. In 1900, no southern states, where over 75% of African Americans lived, were represented in the registration data. But this was changing very slowly. One aspect of how cancer crossed the color line then was related to these matters of epidemiological awareness, who was counted and who was not. A second feature of early 20th century cancer awareness was the problem of disease itself. In a society where infectious diseases predominated as the leading causes of death, with tuberculosis leading the way, it was widely known that poor people lived in a world where early death from such diseases was more likely than among the well-off. Better-off people lived increasingly long enough to live to the cancer-aged, quote-unquote, and to die from the new so-called diseases of civilization. Perhaps then how cancer crossed the color line was a function of how black people began surviving the ravages of infectious disease at different rates than whites, and how they reached the cancer age at a later point in the century. And by the way, statisticians did not practice age adjustment in any systematic fashion during this period. Yet another confounding factor is the numbers was the fact that diagnostic tools for cancer were not evenly distributed, with urban centers far better equipped than rural ones. And given the deficiencies of the diagnostic tools then available, some cancers, particularly women's cancers of the cervix and breast, were far easier to recognize and diagnose clinically than others, such as the so-called quote-unquote internal cancers that predominated in men. These disparities in awareness unquestionably shaped the view that cancer was far more of an urban problem, more of a problem of the well-to-do, and far more worrisome for women than for men. These limitations were not unknown at the time. Of course, we live with our own deficiencies of data. What we have in common with epidemiologists of this era, as well as the urge to make sense of the data, no matter how problematic it may be. These views of cancer as a problem of white, well-to-do women define professional and public discussion and the public imagery of this emerging health threat as well. Parenthetically speaking, these are the images of cancer that predominate in this era. Cancer as a woman's problem, an issue that these women should be especially alert to. And you see some of the literature or the imagery to my left. The concerns about cancer also gave rise to a range of biological theories about what it was about these women that made them particularly vulnerable to cancer's ravages. Theories of cancer and womanhood were closely intertwined, as when one author noted, quote, there is something about the non-functioning of the mammary glands, the turn away from breastfeeding, that is, which disposes them to become cancerous, end quote. It is a familiar theory still used today, in fact. The dominant explanatory framework of these early decades was cancer awareness in an awareness about women and their bodies. As another author wrote in 1928, quote, childbearing entails a tremendous strain on organs and tissues. These organs should be guarded as much as possible from injury. A woman owes it to herself and to her family, end quote. Cancer was, therefore, not an equal opportunity disease, and cancer awareness at its inception involved teaching women how to safeguard these organs and body parts, the breast, the cervix, the uterus, associated with maternity and reproduction. The puzzle for me of why cancer rates were so much lower among African Americans was, for experts of the time, not a puzzle at all. As one New York surgeon, Willie Meyer, wrote in his book, Cancer, Its Origins, Its Development, and Its Self-Perpetuation of 1931, cancer defined the line between the primitive and the civilized people. Quote, primitive people, end quote, he wrote, continuing the quote, in the familiar character of their restful, unchanging surroundings, would almost seem to be on a par with the fish of the ocean, the life of which is spent in placid indifference and the never-changing salt solution with its always equal temperature. Yeah, that's kind of humorous, isn't it? That's my editorial, not Keats. I said it's humorous. Prolonged worry is almost unknown among them. They are absent of nervous and psychic strain, which is the bane of modern civilized man, end quote. Here we have more than a glimpse of the mindset of the era. The dominant explanatory framing of cancer among primitive and uncivilized people who lived in harmonious balance with their environment, like the fish in the ocean, without worry, without stress, and without cancer. They lacked cancer risks, and they also lacked the need and capacity for cancer awareness. We can see in hindsight, of course, how these theories of cancer were defined by prevailing cultural views about race, gender, and the primitive/civilization dichotomy. Theories about Negro immunity and rising susceptibility to diseases of civilization, and theories about the origins of white, well-to-do women's special vulnerabilities. As Frederick Hoffman wrote in 1937, quote, when uncivilized peoples, parentheses, Arabs, comma, Negroes, end parentheses, become civilized, the death rate of cancer reaches the average for civilized people, end quote. And in a curious observation, especially given today's concern about the Southern diet and health, he wrote, quote, a careful study of Negro dietaries, which may protect them against cancer, might be of value, end quote. On the other side of the color line were white women, who had become the primary target of the new public health messaging on cancer awareness. For them, the value of maternal responsibility and self-education was stressed. As one author on the psychology of cancer noted in the mid-1920s, quote, in the lives of primitives, there is no symbolism born in the collective unconscious as we all, in the lives of primitives, there is no symbolism. Born in the collective unconscious as we all are, they never leave it while we are supposed to educate ourselves, end quote. Cancer was, in this sense, a call for responsibility. My argument here is that this framing of cancer in the color line had long-lasting implications for public health. As C.C. Little, the president of the American Society for the Control of Cancer, which is, the precursor to the American Cancer Society, commented, cancer is, quote, a public health problem peculiarly adapted to the needs and attitudes of educated women, unquote. Thus was modern cancer awareness founded on a powerful association of gender identity, class, and the belief in the power and capacity of self-surveillance. Women had unique cancer vulnerabilities determining their need for greater alertness. Observations like this were widespread. Quote, unfortunately, cancer afflicts women in a very much larger proportion than it does men, for the simple reason that there are two organs in women which cancer frequently occurs that raise the percentage, the breast and the womb, end quote. Not surprisingly, then, the first breast cancer self-examination movement in the early 1950s was founded on these premises. Here women gather to watch the film, and hear an image from the film being projected in a larger theater. At mid-century, these new mass media techniques, which is the motion picture, were becoming crucial conduits for disseminating these ideas more broadly. The first half of the century then defined a script from which cancer awareness messages would continue to draw, and from 1900 into the 1960s, at least three generations of American women would be coached, cajoled, taught, and educated to internalize these risk beliefs and engage in these risk avoidance practices. The impact of this history is still felt today, of course. For decades, and arguably still today, cancer awareness was built upon a powerful racial asymmetry. Then as now, many cancer experts insist on reading the numbers at face value, looking past the flaws in how they are gathered, and speculating about what those disparities tell us about biological racial differences. Ironically, in the early 20th century, they worried over black immunity. Now they puzzle over black genetic susceptibility. Then as now, perhaps more implicit today, well-to-do educated women are projected as possessing capacity for self-awareness and self-surveillance, the cornerstone of that being the breast self-examination. Cancer awareness in the U.S. has been defined by these motifs and messages over many generations, and is only since the 1970s, really, that popular and professional attention began to swing to how the so-called other half died and what the cancer experience is like across the color line. My book attempts to weave this complicated story into a theory of how and why epidemiological awareness changes over time, how epidemiological theory is embedded in the broader cultural theories of group identity, as well as in the politics and cultural dynamics of the era. Finally, while I set out to write a history of cancer awareness, epidemiology, and communication, in the end, the book is as much a study of cancer and my miscommunication regarding epidemiology, race, and health disparities. I've emphasized today another feature of the book, the powerful and shifting role of media in framing cancer, race, and difference. For those less interested in the long view and more of the recent trajectory, the final chapter of the book, called The New Politics of Old Differences, argues that these origins of cancer awareness, which you might argue is long past, are very much still active and exert powerful force in public health debates. This final chapter takes up three stories: the case of African American men and prostate cancer, the case of Vietnamese immigrants and cervical cancer, and the case of women in Marin County, California, and breast cancer, to examine how longstanding ideas about biological blackness, white affluence, and primitives making progress continue to shape cancer ideas and ideologies today. Thank you very much.